Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. We're excited to announce that we will now be releasing these episodes every week on Wednesday morning. The best way to support us is by clicking subscribe and taking a moment to rate the podcast wherever you listen. If you'd like to support our efforts to keep the nonprofit Meditation Center open in Nashville, you can donate via the Venmo app by sending your donation to @WildHeartNashville. Or you can go to wildheartmeditationcenter.org and click the donate tab. Thanks for listening. So tonight I wanted to kind of pick up off where I ended my last talk. When I reached the Buddhist path, as I described last time, I had kind of bottomed out on happiness. I'd chased my own two dead ends of chasing the high of instant gratification, relationships, and then got clean and chased the high of likability and approval and becoming a good person. And everything that I thought that would make me happy wasn't working. And then I found this practice, and almost instantly for me it started to ease my mind in a way that I wasn't used to. The practice of mindfulness offered me an opportunity to get a little bit of space from the mind, from the thoughts. To see my thoughts more impersonally, to see my thoughts and feelings and emotions as impermanent, changing. Sometimes they say that people enter into the Dharma through one of two doors, the wisdom door or the heart door. I was more interested in the wisdom side of things. And when I started to be introduced to these heart practices, it felt like more of a chore than anything else. I felt like I was in Dharma detention. Saying the phrases over and over and over again, nothing sinking in. Right? Like Bart Simpson at the beginning of every episode up on the blackboard. May I be at ease. May I be at peace. May I be kind and gentle with myself. But because I'd started to gain some trust in the practice of mindfulness and started to get a little bit of space from my mind, a little bit of space from these emotions, I had some degree of faith or some degree of trust that maybe these other practices of loving kindness, of compassion, of appreciative joy, of equanimity, that they might one day sink in if I kept going. And I remember distinctly one time sitting a compassion day retreat with my teacher Dave. And he gave us the phrases, something very similar to the phrases we're using today. May I open to the pain and difficulties in my life. May I care for the pain and difficulties in my life. May I be free with the pain and difficulties in my life. And as I sat there, there was a lot of pain. There was physical pain, but there was a lot of what I had come into the Dharma with. There was a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of resistance. And at some point throughout the sit, I dropped the phrases and I just got really curious in this feeling in my chest. It felt sharp. And as I sat with it, it started to grow. And at that moment, Dave said something like, caring is enough. Caring is enough. And it's hard to put into words, but after I gave up on the phrases and just sat there with the pain, it was like I had stopped trying to force a solution to my life. It was just me and the pain together. And I started to feel it, and I started to realize that the heartache that I felt in the first place was because I cared so much. I was in so much pain because I cared so much. And that all I needed to do was care, and it was already there in the pain. And I think I'd been like throwing these compassion phrases down at my heart, just hoping they would land. And I realized I didn't need to do anything else about it. Just be there with it. Open to it, care for it. And I was free to be with it. It was right there in the phrases all along. And as I continued my practice over the next few months, I kind of had this realization, of course it's easier to put it into words now, but that I'd spent so much time estranged from my own heart that I felt like I didn't deserve my own love. It was so foreign to me. But I was at this turning point where I also had spent so much time away from my own heart that I felt like I didn't deserve that either. My own self-abandonment. And so I was in this kind of like Dharma purgatory. I felt like I had crossed over one shore but had not yet arrived into the other. And I knew at that time, as my teachers taught me, that I couldn't hate myself into being a better person, but I hadn't yet figured out that I could love myself and how to do that. So my teachers assured me that the natural state of the heart and mind is that it's bright, it's radiant, it's luminous. And that it is only obscured by these visiting tendencies of our mind. This is what Ajahn Chah meant earlier with saying that the mind within itself is already peaceful. Have you all noticed any of these visiting tendencies? The five hindrances: craving, aversion, lethargy, restlessness and agitation, and doubt. And what they are a hindrance to is the heart mind's natural radiance. It's natural clarity and understanding. In Pali Sanskrit, the word for hindrance is nawarana, which means covering up. And I want to talk a little bit about the Buddha's own experience with visiting tendencies, and to dive a little bit deeper into a part of the story that we didn't get to the other night. It's story time, so feel free to relax. Once Siddhartha had been nourished back to life by Sujata, who was the farmer's daughter that had fed him when he was at the point of starvation, he set out on his resolve to sit down underneath the Bodhi tree and to not get up until he had conquered the suffering and confusion in his mind. He was determined to not get up until he had freed himself from all of the forms of misidentification, of attachment, and of aversion in his mind. So he sits down just like we did today, just like we've been doing for the last several days. And he was feeling his breath, sensing his breath as it comes and goes, investigating the pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral sensations and feelings and thoughts. And he started to open his awareness in a more compassionate way. Mindfulness. Not trying to stop any experience, no matter how unpleasant it may feel, but instead meeting each moment with kindness and compassion. And this was a breakthrough moment. But just as the Buddha started to open up his awareness, he was visited by a demon named Mara. Mara's first line of attack is hatred, anger, violence. Mara tried to expose Sid's attachment to pleasure by raining violence down on him, thinking that if there was enough discomfort, he'd get up and abandon his pursuit of this higher happiness, this genuine happiness. So Mara wages a war on Sid, shooting arrows and throwing spears in an attempt to deter Siddhartha from his goal. But he continued to sit, seeing clearly that Mara was only an aspect of his mind. He radiates love and compassion throughout his being and turns the weapons of hatred into flowers that shower down all around him. Next, Mara attacks with lust. A group of beautiful women, naked, arrived to tempt the Buddha to be with his desire. But he continued to sit peacefully, reflecting on the fact that the happiness that he was seeking will never come from a fleeting experience of sensual pleasure. He allowed the desire to arise and pass away, without clinging to it or identifying with it as personal. Of course, feeling rejected and confused, to accept their invitation of sensual desire, the dancing women retreated. So he continues to sit there, unmoved by the mind's insistence. Mara takes one final stab at Siddhartha, attacking him with the most debilitating weapon of all, Siddhartha's most formidable opponent, doubt. He challenges and taunts Siddhartha with criticism and judgment. Mara tells Sid he is worthless and conceited to think that he can fully awaken. He says, "Who do you think you are? Everyone is identified with the body, attached to pleasure, afraid of pain. How dare you try to be different?" Yet Sid has by now seen through his mind's limitations and understood by turning his awareness on the mind itself, he can see through the doubts and fears that arise. He knows that the doubts of the Mara mind are not true. They are just another phenomenon that arises and passes. Doubt, doubt, doubt. To prove his resolve, he touches the earth to bear witness to the four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, that make up all forms in existence, as he continues to be mindful and aware of his mind and body. Siddhartha's main practice was investigative, compassionate, present time awareness. Though he had learned to get the mind concentrated with his study with these other gurus early in his life, he had not learned to open his awareness to present time experience. This was the breakthrough that led to his freedom. Around dawn, Mara understood that he no longer had power over Sid. Mara had been defeated. With no more ammunition or means of attack, he sulked dejectedly off to find another victim. Sid just sat there feeling his breath and sensations coming and going. And he realized that everything is impermanent. Every physical and mental experience arises and passes. Everything in existence is endlessly arising out of causes and conditions. He saw that we all create suffering for ourselves through our resistance, through our desire to have things different than the way we want them to be, That is our clinging and aversion. And also through our over-identification with these thoughts, feelings, and sensations. That is taking them personally. Siddhartha understood if he just let go and was mindful and accepting without grabbing or pushing, he would be free and at peace with life. Sometimes I get asked, what's the goal of Buddhist meditation? Ultimately, awakening. But for me, over the years, I feel like the true fruit of the practice has been something that we call equanimity. It's something we'll talk a lot more about in a couple days. Equanimity in Pali Sanskrit comes from this word upekkha, which means there in the middleness. To be in the middle of it all. Not pushing it away, not indulging in it, just aware. Letting it come and go, not taking it personally. Easier said than done, right? It being Ajahn Chah Day, I wanted to read an oldie but a goodie. This is from A Still Forest Pool. Try to be mindful and let things take their course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a still forest pool. All kinds of wonderful animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. You will see many strange and wonderful things come to drink from the pool. These are the visiting tendencies of the mind, the five hindrances. And I like looking at these as strange and wonderful creatures because I think it really speaks to the reason why the hindrances exist in the first place. They're just creatures of the mind, just trying their best to protect us, to keep us safe in their own way, building in some ways a fortification around the heart. We translated dukkha the other night in one of its forms as vulnerability, susceptibility to woundedness. And it's the hindrances that try to protect and defend the vulnerable heart. Fortification, the definition is the action of building a defensive wall or other reinforcement to strengthen a place against attack. And it's often these moments of dukkha in our own lives that have formed the fortification, have given fuel to the hindrances that keep them around for protection. Like I said previously, the word for this in Sanskrit is nawarana, which means covering up. Covering up the mind's natural state of radiance and peace. Now, this view is mostly in Mahayana Buddhism. The mind itself is already radiant, peaceful, luminous, pure. But it actually also has some context in early Buddhist discourses as well. The Buddha himself says that the natural state of the mind is likened to a bowl of water. And each of the hindrances, each of the five hindrances, each have a different way that they affect the clarity of the water, the clarity of the mind. The first of the five hindrances is sensual desire, craving. And the way that this affects the clarity of the heart and the mind is it's as if water was dyed with a drop of color. It's the old rose-colored glasses. Wanting something else. Seeing something else. being enamored in the promises of something else, that something else will make me happy. Seeing through that lens. Now, like all of our hindrances in some ways, it's not our fault. Especially this one, craving. It's natural to our biology. Wanting and not wanting, wanting things to be pleasant, not wanting things to be unpleasant. Even Melvin Connor, a neuroscientist, said that the chronic internal state of the human nervous system is a vague mixture of anxiety and desire, best described by the phrase, I want, spoken with or without an object for the verb. Sense of restless wanting, longing. Blaise Pascal, the 18th century French philosopher, says that all human suffering stems from the fact that we can't sit quietly in a room by ourselves. Yet here we are. But what is that longing, that impulse to reach outside of ourselves for happiness? This is called tanha, thirst. Now, it's important to maybe note that there's a difference between desire and craving. In Buddhist psychology, desire is called an ethically neutral mental factor. It's a really beautiful name, isn't it? This means that desire can lean towards wholesomeness or unwholesomeness. It can lead towards wisdom or ignorance. But desire itself is a neutral mental state. There's nothing wrong with having desire. As a matter of fact, there are wholesome forms of desire in Buddhist psychology. The word for this is chanda. Chanda, when defined, means an eagerness to commit and apply oneself to a goal. And this goal being genuine happiness. So we have chanda in our practice here. You know, when you have that desire to go out there and the sun's beating down and it's like, oh, I'm just going to do the walking meditation anyway. You know, when we want to duck out on our sila, our ethical living, you know, when it's so much easier to just stay at home and watch Netflix instead of show up for a friend or, you know, to take care of the people in our lives, that eagerness to commit and apply ourselves to that happiness of sharing, generosity, of compassion, of gratitude. Right? Because our gratitude really speaks through our action, through this chanda, through this type of desire. Now, tanha is not a choice, actually, it's a reflex. It's the biological habit. It's an impulse. It's an impulse that we often act on. It's an impulse most of the time we rationalize before we act on. It's the desire to pull something in and feed on it. That's what Ajahn Sucitto says. I like that. To pull something in. Here's what he has to say about this type of desire, tanha. It's a desire that is never satisfied because it just shifts from one emotional need to the next, from one sense of achievement to another goal. It's a desire that comes from a black hole of need, however small and manageable that need is. So tanha is not desire. It's not a great translation for it. It's a thirst, it's a feverish longing, it's a demanding the satisfaction of desire. Now, we often don't see it this way because tanha is very convincing. It says, my happiness exists in this thing outside of myself. My happiness exists in this moment of pleasure, or in becoming this person, or not becoming this person. These are the three forms of craving that the Buddha expounds upon in his teaching. It's the craving for sense pleasure, sensory input, the gratification through the eyes and ears and nose and mouth and body and mind. And then there's, I really like that he expounds upon this, because I see this a lot in myself and in our culture, especially here in the West, is the craving for becoming. It's called bhava tanha. Craving for existence, craving to become something that we are not. This is the craving of deficiency. As it is not enough. I need to be better. I need to have a better body. I need to be more attractive. I need to have a better job. I need to have more money. I need to have more likability, more praise, more popularity, more status. Self-improvement. I need to improve the self. The Dharma offers a way to improve without the self. Less of the self, more improvement. How this shows up for me, and trust me, it shows up for me. If only X, then Y. Or once I get, or I'd rather be. These are just some of the ways that I notice my mind starting these sentences of bhava tanha, craving for existence. I really thought that when I moved into my new house, I was going to become friends with all the neighbors. I was going to start jogging more. I was going to be a different person. The crazy thing is, I didn't even dislike the person I already was. It's insidious. And it gets more insidious, I feel like, as I continue to practice. It's like, yeah, I like who I am today, this version of myself. But the mind's like, well, maybe it could be a little bit better. Craving for existence or craving for becoming is not a sensory experience. It's more abstract, like the craving for likability. And we maybe even notice this. They have a word for it on retreat. For those that don't know, this is sometimes called a vipassana retreat. But vipassana is a Pali Sanskrit word for insight meditation. And that they call this type of craving for becoming sometimes on retreat, the form that we see it take is this vipassana romance. Falling in love with the object of our desire. It's kind of funny that it happens. It happens to me all the time on retreat. The mind imagining a life with someone else, what would it be like? We don't like to share these thoughts with other people. I see everyone like, don't move my head. But I'll take your laughter as a maybe sign that some of that's going on. False promise. The false promise is somehow our existential loneliness will be satisfied by becoming some other version of ourselves. Do we ever get there? Vibhava tanha. That's what I like about the Pali language, is they just take a word and then they put like two letters in front of it and it means something completely different. Usually just means the opposite of. Craving for non-existence. Craving to get rid of some part of an experience, or all of an experience, especially experiences that we perceive to be related to our identity, ourselves. So one way we see this running rampant in our culture is the pressure to be in a certain kind of body, to look a certain kind of way, hating the body. pressure of prevailing social norms, is what Bhikkhu Bodhi said in the chapter. Getting rid of aging, we've declared a war on the most natural thing that exists. Hide it, cover it up. No judgment if you use makeup and things like that, right? But it's that intention behind the things that we do, right? It's really looking into it. It's like, am I not wanting to be in this body? Am I not wanting to be seen in this body? Do I feel unlovable in this body? To be honest, I don't like telling people I'm a Buddhist teacher. When I'm sitting down next to someone on an airplane, I don't want to be that role. What do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a social worker. You ever tried to explain to a Southern businessman why you teach Buddhism? Small moments of craving for non-existence. Can't I just be something else? I don't want to project onto our friend Santikara, but also wearing the robes, I imagine, sometimes. It's just a highlighting and a noticing of feeling othered. You know, wearing them with pride at times. I've heard Ajahn Sachito talk about this as well, but also how much he hates going to the airport, you know, wearing the orange robe and the types of things that are said to him. Some of us are in recovery, and so sometimes we don't want people to know that identity and that role. Some of us may have told our family members that we're just renting an Airbnb at the beach this week and to not talk to us. Yeah. Craving for non-existence in its most extreme forms is wanting a way out of existence. Suicidality, which is another form of craving. And it's not to judge those mind states that arise. I mean, it makes sense. You know, when we're in pain, we want a way out. You know, at least when I was younger, I had the drugs and alcohol, you know. I tell people all the time, if I didn't have that, I don't know if I would be here today. You know, because how suicidal, how much I didn't want to exist in my life as a kid. So it's not a judgment, it's just noticing that there's still this longing to get out, to be out. And that this path really offers us a beautiful way to be in. To be in the middle of it. The second is aversion and ill will. The metaphor for this is water that has come to a boil. I like this metaphor because if you ever look in a pot of boiling water, you're cooking something, it's hard to see what you're cooking inside. It's hard to see through the anger and irritation and frustration, isn't it? It's one of the most powerful emotions and mind states. This is similar to craving. It's just craving in the opposite direction. Wanting things to be different than the way that they are in the sense of, I hate this. This pain in my knee. The sun on my back. This person talking to me right now. It's the automatic impulse or habit of the mind to dismiss, to avoid, to resist, to become irritable, angry, resentful in the face of unwanted experiences. Pain, failure, disrespect, criticism. There are a few. I find my aversion. Pro tip about mindfulness, just a little tangent here. When mental agitation is present, we may be using mindfulness as a technique to attempt to get rid of the unpleasant experience by meditating it away. So aversion tries to get rid of aversion. Something I watch happen all the time in my own mind. We also have a word for this on retreat. We call it Vipassana Vendetta. We find the person breaking all the rules, not practicing the right way, again, it's just what the mind does. They call, in the Buddhist discourses, they call anger the honey-tipped dart. This is a weird thing about anger. It kind of feels good at first, doesn't it? And in emotional psychology, they say anger is mostly followed by regret and remorse. And they call those secondary emotions. Emotions that incarnate other emotions. So we've learned a couple ways of working with these over the last week. We've learned to notice the arising of the craving and the aversion, to note it as wanting or not wanting. Notice the contraction in the body, to soften, to open the heart with compassion. Learning how to meditate on loving kindness. One of the anti-hindrances that the Buddha offers for all of the hindrances, the antidotes, is noble friendship and suitable conversation. You ever notice when we share our neurotic shortcomings with noble friends and suitable friends? Pain lessened is, or pain shared is pain lessened a lot of the times. Lethargy, water with algae and moss growing in it. The interesting way of the discourse is framing lethargy as sloth and torpor, which are words we don't use very often in our modern vernacular. But it's actually interesting, when I looked into it, the definitions of these words actually helped me to understand lethargy better. Sloth is a lack of driving power, a reluctance to work, to make an effort. So sloth is kind of like the animal, the sloth, right? It's that kind of like lack of driving power. It's a sunken feeling of lethargy. It's hard to get up and go. It's the part of us, it's the mind state that hits the snooze alarm in the morning. That's the sloth. Part of lethargy. Not right now. It's a common characteristic of depression, right? This absence of motivation or drive. So lethargy is often right there with depression as well. And again, we're not judging it, we're just noticing. Torpor is a sluggishness of mental factors. It's hard to access attention. It's hard to access our inquiry or our mental energy or our self-awareness. So the example of this is, it's like you're stuck at the bottom of a well. Sloth is that reluctance to even start crawling up. Like, what's the point? I don't have it in me. And torpor is that dullness of mind that has trouble planning how I would even do it in the first place. Where would I start? The mind has two functions, doing and knowing. The role of meditation is to calm the doing while keeping the knowing present. Sleepiness occurs when we sometimes carelessly calm both the doing and the knowing. Working with lethargy. Practicing wise reflection. What causes lethargy? The Buddha says that oftentimes what causes lethargy is frequently giving attention to unskillful mind states. Interesting that it's not just our activities and our schedule that makes us fatigued and burned out, but it's the all of the giving attention to unskillful mind states around those things. Sometimes it's as simple as just indulging and overindulging in tiredness and boredom. Right? Or sloth and torpor can masquerade as self-compassion some of the time. I hate that. I'm going to take care of myself and rest. It's that middle path, right? How do we find that balance? What is really restful right now is a good question when that's happening. It's hard to lie to myself when I ask myself specific questions. So sometimes when I'm like, I've had a long day, I'm gonna rest. Instead of whatever it might be, meditate, ask myself the question, what would really be restful for you? Practicing wise reflection. The Buddha talks about overconsumption, not just of food, but of caffeine, of consuming anything, consuming too much media, too much screen, too much, a lot of things. It's all stimulation. During our meditation practice, we can work with it, opening the eyes, adjusting the posture, standing meditation, walking meditation instead of sitting meditation. You know, it's been interesting over the past year. I've been curious about this. I've been working a lot with fatigue and lethargy over the last couple years. And every once in a while when I get tired in my meditation practice, I'll get up and I'll do walking meditation. And that doesn't sound like a crazy thing for a Buddhist teacher to say, but it's something that I didn't really do before at home. You know, get up and continue the practice. Another way to take care of our lethargy, I'm spending a bit of time on lethargy because it's a big one, isn't it? Is to also take a rest. I heard this shared during the group interviews today. A skillful way of approaching lethargy sometimes is to stop fighting it, to take a nap and then to see if you're more energized. And then we can see if the lethargy persists, if it continues, we can be curious. And we can notice that sometimes sloth and torpor are kind of like a fortification, a defense from emotions and things that are kind of underneath the surface that are hard to be aware of when the mind is dull and tired. And so the mind actually has kind of learned, the nervous system's learned to kind of dissociate in a way. And noble friendship and suitable conversation. Restlessness and worry. Agitation, overexcitement, distractibility of mind. It's the quality of mind in Pali Sanskrit, I forget the word for it, but it's translated to mean quivering above. Right? A lot of times when I'm restless, I'm not really in the body. I'm not really connected to the body. I'm kind of in this space of mental scatteredness, of mental proliferation. My thoughts get fast. The anxiety in my chest quivers above. In meditation, similar to lethargy, actually, we can work with this through walking meditation, through opening the eyes. I've heard one teacher describe being in Myanmar on a retreat for, I think, 3 months, and just a ton of restlessness. And she self-admitted that she's a very type A person. She heard the teachings and she was like, enlightenment or bust, like I'm all in. And she ramped herself so up like for a month, just going, going, going. And during her interviews and check-ins, she couldn't kind of see this type of striving. And so it just kept agitating her mind and she kept ignoring it and kept going. And she eventually went in and broke down. She had a breakdown and talked to the Sayadaw, the teacher. And he said, what I want you to do is called pile of meat practice. He said, no technique, just sit like a pile of meat. And sometimes when I'm just in there, you know, like trying to meditate, I'm just like, pile of meat practice. I had a lot of other thoughts I won't share with you. Doubt, the most formidable opponent. This is likened to murky or dirty water. Oh, restlessness was, I think, water stirred by the wind. Yeah. Doubt is murky or dirty water. So in Zen Buddhism, they praise doubt. And it's this other type of doubt. It's called investigative doubt, this kind of constructive form of doubt. Investigative doubt is a questioning and investigative quality of mind that assists in the dropping of fixed views. Like kind of when we ask ourselves, like, do I really believe that's true? When we challenge our views or our automatic assumptions, trying to see things with an open mind, with a beginner's mind. This type of investigative doubt helps us relinquish our rigidity of fixed views and move towards deeper exploration of the actual nature of experience. But this isn't the hindrance of doubt. The hindrance of doubt is called skeptical doubt, a deluded or confused state of mind that's overcome by perplexity and indecision. When we think of doubt, we often think of more of the content of doubt. I doubt the practice, I doubt myself, can I do this? Is the teaching right? But if you actually look at the behavior of doubt, it's oftentimes this kind of perplexity and indecision. A lot of times I doubt when it's like I don't want to commit to something because there's uncertainty. You know, so doubt is often a reaction to the fear that comes from the nature of the world being uncertain and groundless. So we try to say, well, this is my thing to believe in, or this is my view. And then these views change. You know, we've seen this socially and culturally too over the last several years. And it's great that views change. But then we all wrestle with it. You know, would any of us want, you know, if we had Twitter when we were in high school, people to read those tweets? Probably not. Because we evolve, we change. Changing views is a good thing, but when those views shift, there's a lot of perplexity, there's a lot of doubt, indecision. Who am I now? What do I believe now? And Buddhism sees the beauty of this space. Because in this space of groundlessness is really where change happens, where transformation happens. I've heard one Buddhist teacher say that the Buddhist path is like jumping out of an airplane and then realizing you don't have a parachute. And you're falling and falling and falling. And then you realize there's no ground. The Buddha said that doubt is the most destructive of all the hindrances on the path to well-being because it's the only hindrance that can get us off the path. Two voices of my skeptical doubt is, what do you think you're doing? You're going the wrong way. This isn't the right path. Or who do you think you are? You're not capable of this type of freedom. You're not deserving of this type of love. That compassion practice really hit everyone, but not me. Not you. It's not gonna. Working with doubt. It's like my teacher taught me. Doubt, doubt, doubt. Doubt by its very nature is based in delusion. It's hard to see when we're in delusion or confusion. So if you see it and name it, that's huge. And when my teacher helped point it out to me, it was huge. I could just see it as an impermanent, impersonal mind state. Taking refuge, having some practice around faith. Not faith in what we have yet to experience, but faith in what we have already experienced. This is the ass backwards thing about faith, is we're so conditioned to think faith is about blind trust. But in Buddhism, the word for faith, sada, means something like confidence, verified faith. We actually have to repeatedly look at, the word is anupassati, to repeatedly look at what has worked. The sada, the faith, the confidence. So having a practice around this, taking refuge is a way of saying, like, I'm not taking refuge in what is yet to come. I'm taking refuge in what has brought me here. And noble friendship and suitable conversation. It's a particularly powerful one for doubt, isn't it? The power of mindfulness is opening to all experience with wisdom and compassion. The wisdom to see all thoughts, mind states, feelings, and sensations as impermanent. The wisdom that all thoughts, mind states, feelings, and sensations are impersonal. The compassion to let go of grasping after and resisting experience, and to open up our hearts to the flow of life. This was the Buddha's great insight as he sat there underneath the Bodhi tree, to let go, let go, let go. I'll close with Ajahn Chah, how about that? Simplify your meditation practice down to just two words, let go. Rather than trying to develop this practice and develop that practice and achieve this and go into that and understand this and read the suttas and study the texts on Buddhist psychology and then learn Pali Sanskrit, then learn the Prajnaparamita and then ordinations and the Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, write books and become a world-renowned authority on Buddhism, instead of becoming the world's expert on Buddhism and being invited to great international Buddhist conferences, let go. I did nothing but this for 2 years. Every time I tried to understand or figure things out, I'd say, let go, let go, let go, until the desire would fade out. So I'm making it very simple for you, to save you from getting caught in incredible amounts of suffering. There's nothing more sorrowful than having to attend international Buddhist conferences. Some of you might have the desire to become the Buddha of your age, but instead, I must suggest becoming an earthworm instead, letting go of the desire to become the Buddha. Just be an earthworm who only knows two words, let go, let go, let go. We'll sit for a moment.